This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Great to have you with us again. Well, many Americans today rightly fear Islamic terror, which dramatically made its way into our consciousness on 9/11. But there is another danger to our country and to our way of life from Islam, and that is the threat to our free speech. In fact, as my next guest points out, Islamic activists, in tandem with the left, are waging war against our First Amendment. And so we're going to talk about it now with Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, bestselling author, and he is out with a new book called The Complete Infidel's Guide to Free Speech and Its Enemies. Robert, it's great to talk to you again. Welcome.
Thank you, Janet. Always good to be here.
Thank you so much. All right, start by telling people a little bit about this campaign that Islamic activists are waging against our constitutional rights. What do people need to know?
This is an international effort. It's been going on for years, and it is multi-pronged. It's very advanced, and it's very powerful, and most people have no idea of it. For one thing, there has been an ongoing effort at the UN. Hillary Clinton, when she was Secretary of State, signed on to a resolution calling on member states to criminalize incitement to religious hatred. Right. Now, incitement to religious hatred is an entirely subjective judgment, and it really just depends on the values, priorities, and beliefs of the person who's determining what it is. And in this case, it would all be about stifling criticism of Islam. Hillary Clinton explained in a closed-door meeting in Istanbul with Muslim leaders that the U.S. has the freedom of speech, the First Amendment, but that they would circumvent it by using old-fashioned techniques of peer pressure and shaming. And you can see how well that's worked, Janet, over the last few years with people being afraid to speak out, being afraid to be labeled an Islamophobe, a racist, a bigot, all the things that people have come to expect that they will be called if they speak out about this threat.
Right.
And then recently, even more, the social media giants, Facebook, Twitter, Google, the rest of them, they are steadily cutting the ground out from under all critics of Islam. Now, people might find this hard to believe, but there was just a recent news item where Google agreed, after pressure from Muslim leaders, that they would change around their search results in order to make only positive material about Islam come up when you search for words like jihad or taqiyya or sharia, things like that, and the negative results or critical results about Islam would be buried. And the vice president of Facebook actually went to Pakistan recently and told the Pakistani government that they would be removing all material critical of Islam. Mm-hmm. And in February, my website, Jihad Watch, which just tracks jihad activity in the U.S. and around the world, it was censored by Facebook. It dropped 90% the referrals from Facebook to Jihad Watch in mid-February, clearly in the accord with their assurances to the Pakistani government. Any material critical of Islam, it's not going to be on Facebook, or you're not going to be able to spread it. It's not going to be on Google. We're essentially adopting Sharia blasphemy laws in all the primary means of communication today.
That is astonishing. And yet you've brought up a really important fact when you talk about Mark Zuckerberg and the leftists at Facebook and Hillary Clinton, a leftist herself. Many people don't understand why in the world would Americans who were there on 9/11 and saw all the horrors of Islamic jihad that have been perpetrated on the American people over the years and around the world do this when they clearly understand that this is a religion that produces people who are a direct violent threat to us. What is in it for the left in getting in bed with this kind of push for against free speech?
Well, I think that the left in the first place is rather tending toward authoritarianism itself.
Rather.
It doesn't like dissent.
Right.
Leftists never want to discuss, never want to debate. Just a few days ago, there was a professor in Canada who somebody sent around a couple of my articles in this big circular email to all these people, most of them that I did not know. And this professor in Canada responded by saying, I have referred this to the Canadian Edmonton hate speech units or whatever, you know, some crazy thing they've got in Canada restricting the freedom of speech. And so since she had responded on this circular email, I wrote to her myself and said, how do you determine what is hate speech and what's legitimate criticism? Or is there any legitimate criticism of Islam and the current immigration policies in the West and so on? Or is it all to be consigned to the realms of hate speech and forbidden? And she only wrote back that I should check with the Human Rights Commission. She would not discuss, would not debate, would not engage. And this is the left. They want to shut down all critics.
So do
Sharia-compliant Muslims who want to apply Sharia blasphemy laws in the West. And so we have this unholy alliance, as David Horowitz calls it, between the left and Islam, and they both want to shut down our ability to discuss these issues, and they're achieving remarkable success without anybody really realizing what's going on.
Yeah, that's what's so disturbing about it. And we have this long history, as you talk about in your book, of people who are really threatened. Salman Rushdie, you know, you think of Kurt Westergaard, who drew that Danish cartoon of Muhammad with a bomb in his turban. He survived what was in an axe attack after he did that. You know,
we
see this, and this is all rooted in Islam and Islamic law, which you explain in the book. Can you tell people a little bit about why this hatred for other people's free speech against Islam exists?
Well, Islam is an absolutist religion. It's it proclaims itself to be the only true religion. Of course, so does Christianity and other religions probably as well. The thing about Islam, though, is that Muslims are told in the Quran that they are the ones who bring about the will of Allah on earth, that they have to be the executors of his wrath. In the Bible, of course, it says, vengeance is mine, says the Lord, but there's no idea of that in Islam. Rather, Allah will punish the unbelievers by means of the Muslims, by their hands. And so that being the case, if there is criticism of Islam, if there is anything that is considered to be something that is challenging Islamic claims at all, then it has to be forcibly shut down. And that's all there is to it. And so Islamic law has a death penalty for criticizing Islam. And this is what they're trying to bring here. Not the death penalty yet, but certainly just making it outside the bounds of acceptable discourse to criticize Islam. And we're well on the way.
Well, we are. And yet we were the same country that was all about the hashtag I stand with Charlie Hebdo when that a jihad took place. It seems we forget pretty quickly why it was important that Charlie Hebdo was allowed to operate, not because people wanted to have cartoons and all these sorts of things, but in defense of free speech to say we stand with them. Why aren't we standing with these people now? It seems like that's just gone the way of the horse and buggy now.
Absolutely, Janet. It's very important. As a matter of fact, I have a chapter on that exact thing in the book called From Rushdie to Geller, because Rushdie, when he did get the death fatwa from the Islamic Republic of Iran, there was a whole lot of awareness of the necessity of the freedom of speech, a lot of indignation in the West. Rushdie was a hero for the freedom of speech, and he was celebrated.
Yeah.
And now you go 26 years after that, when Pamela Geller and I had the free speech event in Garland, Texas, that was attacked by jihadis, the Muhammad Art Exhibit and cartoon contest. And it was exactly as you said. We weren't trying to mock Muslims or provoke them or insult them. We were saying, look, if you're going to kill people, if we have jihadis killing the Charlie Hebdo cartoonists in Paris for drawing Muhammad, then we either have to draw Muhammad or surrender and say, yes, you can bully us, you can threaten us into submission, which will only encourage more bullying and threat. So we were standing up, but Pamela Geller was roundly excoriated for our doing this and criticized. And nobody thought, well, this is just like the Rushdie case, and this is another hero of the freedom of speech. It shows how much in 26 years, their appreciation, the understanding of the importance of the freedom of speech has been lost from the West.
It's totally true. And what you often heard about that Garland event, especially aimed at Pamela in particular, was that she was being provocative. She was asking for it. We never would have said these sorts of things 25, 30 years ago.
That's right. That's right. Nobody ever said Rushdie was asking for it or he had it coming or he deserved it. It was taken for granted that the freedom of expression was the foundation of a free society, and you can't have a free society without the freedom of expression. But now it seems as if everybody takes for granted, on the other hand, that you just don't criticize Islam and you don't insult Muslims and don't do anything that they might consider to be offensive.
Absolutely right. Well, we're going to come back. Robert Spencer from Jihad Watch with us. His book, The Complete Infidel's Guide to Free Speech and Its Enemies. Stay with us on Janet Mefford Today.
Here is today's Capitol Hill Brief with Concerned Women for America President Penny Nance.
As the leader of the free world, the United States has a unique role in standing in solidarity with the nation of Israel. Unfortunately, it's becoming less and less politically correct to stand with God's people, and our leaders are hesitant to express their support for fear of being targeted by the radical left. They should know better. Prime Minister Netanyahu said it best. History has shown us time and again that what is right is not what is popular. The fight for Israel may not be a popular one, but it is a fight Concerned Women for America will continue to persist and highlight in our summer of perseverance, clinging to God's promise that blessings will follow.
Now is not the time to resist. Now is the time to persist for faith, family, and freedom. This summer, find out how you can support a positive agenda that protects our country's biblical values at CapitolHillBrief.org. That's CapitolHillBrief.org.
Do you want to experience a closer relationship with God today? Well, the good news is God desires intimacy with you more than you could ever imagine. This is Jeannie Nigro with Unshaken. If you want to grow closer to God, you simply need to think what He thinks and feel what He feels about everything, and that includes Israel. God is passionate about Israel, so much so that out of all His creation, He chose Jerusalem to be the place of His throne forever, and Israel to be a light to the nations. When you share His passion and support Israel in your conversations, social media, prayers, and finances, you experience greater intimacy with God. And intimacy with God is the number one anchor you need to stand strong today. For more on how to remain unshaken in a world that's all shook up, or to download a free chapter of my book, Unshaken, Standing Strong in Uncertain Times, go to jeannienigro.com/Janet. That's JeanneNigro.com/Janet.
We're back on Janet Mefford Today. My guest, Robert Spencer, bestselling author. He's out with a new book, The Complete Infidel's Guide to Free Speech and Its Enemies. You can find him at jihadwatch.org, where he serves as director of Jihad Watch. Robert, as we were talking about some of these important waymarks, really, on the threats to free speech in America, you talked about the Istanbul process, Hillary Clinton saying that we should use these old-fashioned tactics of peer pressure and shaming to get people not to say what we don't want them to say about Islam. We've had the difference between Salman Rushdie and people being outraged by that fatwa against him years ago for the Satanic Verses versus how you and Pamela Geller were treated for doing your event in Garland, Texas. One thing that I think people need to understand is, how do you get from Salman Rushdie to now and use tactics that are effective against the American people to weaken their love and their commitment to free speech? What sorts of things are they doing to achieve what they're doing now?
The primary, and I think the most effective tactic, Janet, has been using charges of racism and bigotry and identifying as hateful any legitimate criticism of Islam. Omar Suleiman is an imam in Texas, and he was one of the leaders of this initiative to get Google to change its search results to only give you positive results about Islam. And Omar Suleiman says, in explaining what he did, that there's legitimate criticism of Islam, and they don't want to hurt that. They just want to rule out hate-filled Islamophobia. Now, there's a catch to that, and the catch is this, that there is no legitimate criticism of Islam that Omar Suleiman or his colleagues have ever identified. They have rather, for years now, have characterized any and all criticism of Islam, no matter how rational, no matter how accurate, no matter how fact-based, no matter how even-tempered and sober and calm, they have attacked it all as hate-filled Islamophobia. And so they have given the American people the impression that there is something wrong, that it makes you immediately a racist and a bigot to say anything negative about Islam. The worst example of this, Janet, was the Fort Dix plot in about 12 years ago, there was a plot in New Jersey of Muslims were going to go into Fort Dix and shoot as many American soldiers as possible before they themselves were killed. And the plot was foiled by a young man who found out about it. But before he reported them to police, which he ultimately did, he went to a friend and he said, should I say anything about this? Should I go to police, or would that be racist?
Ooh.
And that in itself, in a nutshell, is what they've done to make people think that there's something wrong with criticizing Islam, that the freedom of speech has to be thrown out the window in this case, that it's racist even to oppose jihad terrorists who want to commit a massacre.
And aside the point that Islam isn't a race, I don't know why people don't remember that.
That's very important. And also in that case, it's interesting to note that the jihadis in question were Albanians from Eastern Europe. They were all white guys. And so there was no possible racial angle.
So what this really leads to then is another thing that you discuss, which is self-censorship. You have now twisted the mentalities of Americans. I don't want to be seen as a hater or a bigot or an Islamophobe or what have you. And because that is preeminent, then I will begin to make sure I don't say anything that people don't like. So then you're taking away your own free speech, in effect.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And there's a lot of self-censorship, and it's been going on for years. I remember years ago, well over 10 years ago, when the positions that I espouse about Islam were far more mainstream than they are now, which is an indication of the success of these attempts to portray all legitimate criticism of Islam as racism and bigotry. But in any case, I was invited by the U.S. State Department to participate in a seminar about Islam and jihad in Berlin, in conjunction with the German Foreign Ministry. And it was a very interesting few days there. And I was chatting once with a man in the U.S. government, in the U.S. State Department. And we were talking about jihad terrorists. And he said, the Muslims who commit these terrorist crimes, and we're just talking, it was just the two of us, there was nobody else around. And then he stopped himself and he said, oh, well, I guess I shouldn't really call them Muslims. And I thought, what else are you going to call them, Methodists? They're obviously Muslims. They're screaming Allahu Akbar. They're pointing to the Quran to justify their actions. But even back then, in 2006 or 7, he had imbibed and internalized the idea that it's wrong to talk about terrorism in conjunction with Islam. And that was so many years ago. And now it's much, much more common to encounter the idea that there's just something a little bit wrong with criticism of Islam. Criticism of Christianity is edgy and iconoclastic and a little bit heroic and fun.
Right.
But criticism of Islam is racist and bigoted and hateful in itself.
Well, right. Something I had seen you put up on your site just recently. I think it was in London where they had signs that said Allah is gay, and they had signs that said Jesus is gay, and they were made to take down the Allah is gay signs, but the Jesus is gay signs could stay.
That's right, because the British authorities are very, very concerned not to criticize Islam, not to say anything remotely offensive to Muslims. Of course, a lot of what's behind all this is fear, that even amid all the people insisting that Islam is a religion of peace, they're really scared to death.
Yeah.
Because they know Islam's not a religion of peace and that Muslims will kill
right.
for offense. A lot of Muslims will kill you if you offend them. And so they say Islam is a religion of peace, and they take down signs like that that are offensive to Muslims because they know that the Christians aren't going to kill them, but the Muslims might well.
Yeah, and it's so strange to me that the same people who are saying that the threat of Sharia to America is non-existent, and anybody who says there's any kind of threat is crazy and over the top and extremist, but they themselves are submitting to the Sharia. They're the ones who are acting like the dhimmis over and over and over again.
Absolutely, because they are internalizing and imposing upon others Sharia blasphemy laws. And so they're saying there's no Sharia, but they're, as you say, they're just obeying it themselves.
Yeah, it's crazy. Now, what about the hate speech scam? This is such an important angle on this, because there was a time back in United States history within my lifetime where when people talked about hate speech laws, a whole group of Americans, the majority of Americans, said, we don't need hate speech. That's a threat to free speech. And how can you commit a crime any worse based on hatred in your heart? And how can you know what's in somebody's heart? This sort of thing. Nowadays, hate speech seems to have a pretty good support in the United States. And this helps along the cause of those who are trying to suppress free speech when it comes to Islam, right?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I remember being sort of shocked when I first started doing this work publicly, and I'm just presenting analysis of how jihadis use the teachings of Islam to justify violence and supremacism and hatred, and I'm accused of hatred. And I thought that, well, that's so ridiculous. It's just trying to oppose jihad terror. Nobody will take that seriously. Well, it turned out pretty much everybody did. And now the other shoe is dropping. I've seen recently when I've spoken on college campuses, people holding up signs or just saying to me straight out, hate speech is not free speech. What you're saying is hate speech, and it must, does not and should not warrant First Amendment protection. You ought to be shut down and not allowed to speak. And these are American college students who ought to understand the importance of the freedom of speech, but they have been sold this idea that there is a thing called hate speech that is objectively quantifiable, although really it's just what leftists dislike, and they are in favor of criminalizing it. And so I think this is very bad for the future of the nation. We have a whole generation of young people with massive numbers among them not having any idea what the freedom of speech is for and why it's so important.
Exactly right. Well, and you look at what's going on in Europe and also in Canada, as you well know. What do you see coming down the pike in the United States that we need to head off at the pass before we get to that point in threatening our free speech?
Well, you know, recently there was, for example, in the UK, a hamburger vendor who got in an argument with a customer, and he was criticizing Islam, and the customer went to the police and reported him and charged, and he was charged with hate crimes, and he had to pay a fine. And this is the kind of thing that's going to happen. We just saw recently in Canada that they passed this motion, M103, that was condemning Islamophobia, and the Muslim parliamentarian who was sponsoring this motion kept saying, it's just a motion. It does not have legal force. You're hysterical if you're saying that it is something that is going to threaten the freedom of speech. And so, very well then, that's fine, except now it's become clear that it really is threatening the freedom of speech, that there was just recently arrested a critic of Islam named Kevin Johnston. Now, I'm not familiar with his work, but unless he was directly inciting violence, and there's no indication of that from the news reports, he was just arrested for criticizing Islam, which is an offense under Islamic law, but ought not to be an offense under Canadian law. I guarantee you that if he were criticizing Christianity, he would not have been arrested. And this is the kind of thing, it's right across the border now, and it's coming here unless we pay attention to what's happening and stop it.
Absolutely. Now, we don't have President Obama anymore, where a lot of these things were implemented, a lot of these ideas were embraced, but we really need to be on our guard. And it seems to me that what we really need to do is recapture the importance of free speech and pass it down, because I don't worry so much about my generation overall as much as I look at the millennial generation with all these kids on the campuses saying hate speech is not free speech. Once they get into power, if that's the majority position, then we're really going to be in trouble.
It's certainly going to be a struggle. Many people have told me when I was working on this book, they would say, you know, you're really exaggerating here. We have the First Amendment. Well, the thing about the First Amendment is that it's words on a page. It's not going to enforce itself. It's not going to stand up and stop the efforts to erode the right of the freedom of speech. And this is very important. You know, you think about the Second Amendment, the right to bear arms, and it has many vocal and energetic defenders. But the reality is that if you're in Chicago or New York City or Los Angeles or someplace like that, and you try to go buy a gun, you will see that the Second Amendment is essentially a dead letter.
Yeah.
It does not really have any real force.
It does not
enforce itself, and it's been restricted out of all significance. The same thing can happen and is already happening to the First Amendment freedom of speech.
Well, that's why everybody needs to get your book, Robert, The Complete Infidel's Guide to Free Speech and Its Enemies. Robert Spencer from Jihad Watch. Always a pleasure, Robert. Thank you so much for what you do.
Thank you, Janet.
All right. God bless. And we'll be back on Janet Mefford Today. This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a nonprofit healthcare sharing ministry that allows you to control and manage your own healthcare and choose any doctor or hospital in the nation. If you're a freedom-loving American looking for contract-free healthcare, call now 855-585-4237 or go to libertyhealthshare.org. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. I cannot believe that President Trump actually did what he just did. This is just incredible. Yesterday, as you know, he lifted this transgender military thing and kicked it off and said, nope, we're not going to do this. We're not going to have transgenders in the military. We're not going to accept transgender people in the U.S. military. He said that American fighting forces have to be focused on decisive and overwhelming victory. He talked about the distraction. And of course, he did this all on Twitter, his favorite medium. And I just was so surprised. I really was. I was surprised because the word I had received back from a lot of pro-family activists and Christian leaders who have been interacting with the Trump administration is that he just didn't really care about it too much. You know, there had been this 6-month delay on transgenders in the military, and the Pentagon had been looking at different aspects of the issue. Most recently, they were talking about how they were looking at the science. And I said, well, if they're honestly going to look at the science, then they're going to have to get rid of this social engineering, because the science is not on the side of people who have the fictitious idea that a man can become a woman and a woman can become a man. It's gender dysphoria. It's a mental health disorder. It should be treated as a mental health disorder. And so if they do look at the science on this, they would have to conclude this is insanity, not because these people don't deserve some help. I would like to see anybody who is suffering from this condition be able to get the help that they need. But that does not negate the fact that when you do this sort of thing, which President Obama forced down our throats with his transgender inclusiveness and that executive order back when he was president, is to disrupt the entire military. And I've heard from military families talking about how the transgender training has continued to go on. They have to sit there. They have to listen to all this ridiculous rhetoric and propaganda on how you must accept somebody who identifies as the opposite sex. That person will be allowed to shower with you. That person will be allowed to be in the locker rooms with you, or wherever you have an intimate area where you're changing and you're trying to have some privacy with your same sex oriented troops. And nope, you're just going to have to put up with it. It's ridiculous. Not to mention the cost of it all. And interestingly enough, CNS News had pointed this out. A RAND Corporation study showed that this could cost us, just from the sex change operations and all that, $8.4 million annually. That's an awful lot of money. And that was something that Representative Vicky Hartzler from Missouri was trying to do with that amendment that so many Republicans voted down just a few weeks ago. She was trying to point out over the many, I don't know, it was about a 10-year period, it was going to cost us over $1 billion to be able to implement this policy. For what? Social engineering to make the LGBT activists happy? Why in the world would that be a reason to do it? You have to consider the common good of the military. And primarily, you need to consider the mission of the military. The mission of the military is not like your company down the street. It's not like your school. It's not like your family. It's a completely different sort of institution with a different set of rules because of the mission that it has, and that is to fight and win wars. And if you are not implementing policies that enable you to better fight and win wars, then you should not implement them. And this has been historically the way that the U.S. military has operated. And I am delighted at President Trump. Now, I found this interesting. I'm going to get to this in just a second, but I have to throw this in at the very beginning so I don't forget to say it, because sometimes I will forget to say it if I don't say it right away. I saw all sorts of people on social media right after these tweets went out from the president, the activist community, as they like to say, the big gay community, and they were throwing around statistics. There are 15,000 transgenders in the military. Human Rights Campaign was throwing that number around, and I saw some others throwing that around, and I thought, 15,000 transgenders in the military? That doesn't sound right. That sounds hyper-inflated. There's no way there are 15,000 people who think they are a member of the opposite sex who are enlisted in the military. Oh, wait a minute, what's this? The New York Times, and you scroll down in the New York Times story, hardly a bastion of conservatism, and it says this: the policy would affect only a small portion of the approximately 1.3 million active duty members of the military. About 2,450 are transgender, according to a study last year by the RAND Corporation. 2,450 and 15,000. That's a pretty big gap. So could it be that they're fudging the numbers a little bit to try to make it into more of a crisis? Not that it is a crisis at all, but it, more rhetoric, more propaganda. 15,000. And I wonder if anybody stops and says, like I did, 15,000? What are you talking about? There's no way the number's that high. And, well, the New York Times and the Human Rights Campaign will have to have a little meeting and perhaps come to a better number. At any rate, I found this an interesting exchange. This was pretty quickly after the tweets came out from President Trump. Over at CNN, there was an exchange between anchor Poppy Harlow and Republican former Congressman Jack Kingston. Listen to this. Cut one.
He just tweeted this a few moments ago. After consulting with my generals and military experts, please be advised that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Our military must be focused on decisive and overwhelming, and it looks like there's going to be more to come. Congressman Kingston, as someone who worked on the Trump campaign as a fellow Republican, what is your response?
Well, I think that the lead of the statement is that he's listened to his military advisors, which is one of the criticisms from the left and the right often that the president gets, is that he doesn't listen to the key people, whether they're in the intel community or local law enforcement or whatever. So this is a case where he's actually saying, I've sat down, I've heard their concerns. And, you know, I want to say one other thing as a Republican, taking a step back. At the Republican convention last July, he was the first nominee in the history of our party to talk about LGBTQ from the platform of the state arena. And I think, you know, he is a progressive guy. Ted Cruz accused him of having New York values, meaning far right. more tolerant. So I don't think it's, you know, a slam against transgender as much as practicality that his generals and his military leadership is saying not right now.
Now, I find that to be a very odd remark, don't you? That all of a sudden you have this Republican congressman who worked on the Trump campaign trying to shore up Trump's progressive cred. Why in the world are you doing that? Do you ever see anybody on the Democrat side trying to defend a Democrat by saying, well, he did something very liberal, but, you know, he does have very conservative ideals? And kind of backpedaling and trying to defend the person who just did something good by saying, actually, they have an opposite viewpoint. What is that other than PR trying to shore up his, like I said, progressive street cred? It just seems so unnecessary. I've never seen such self-loathing at times within this party. It drives me a little bit nuts. Now, listen to this. This is interesting. Commentary from anchor John Berman with Jen Psaki, formerly of Obama's White House. Cut to.
The president, and when he was a candidate, did say Caitlyn Jenner could come use the bathrooms at Trump Tower anytime he wanted. He did take a position there. However, this was an important issue, I think, to the transgender community. Let me just read you the rest of the statement from the president, because that just came out. He was talking about the military. He doesn't want them to be overburdened. He cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption the transgender in the military would entail. Thank you. You know, Jen Psaki, one point here. First of all, the president just made an official policy statement right now this morning. He did it on Twitter. As some people say, you shouldn't pay attention to Twitter. Well, this is a big policy decision the president has just made right there. And that's how he chose to do it, which is why we're discussing it right now. This was from President Obama, whom you worked for. This was, you know, a decision he made to open up the military to transgender troops. Your reaction now to the president's statement.
Well, first of all, it's not a decision that any president just makes in the Oval Office by themselves. President Obama made that decision after careful consideration and consultation for months and months and months with high-level members of the military who wanted the time to consider whether it could be implemented. So I'm just going to take Donald Trump's tweet and blame or a statement that he consulted with military leaders with a grain of salt, because there really has already been months and years of consultation and consideration. I think this is a purely political decision and something he's doing to try to satisfy his right wing. Nothing more than that. It's really disappointing because there has been a lot of thought that was put into that policy. The country has changed. The country has moved. And the military had put a lot of planning into making that policy decision to begin with.
Oh, sure. Yes. Obama's decision to put forward an executive order to make the military transgender inclusive. That was all based on firm policy and on the best for the military, and it was thoroughly vetted. Sure. Then why didn't Congress weigh in on it? Why was it shoved down the throats of the U.S. military? And what about all the men and the women in the military who object to the social engineering? Do they matter at all? We already know how the left handles these sorts of things. We're not going to be fooled. We'll be coming back on Janet Mefford Today. Stay with us. Isn't that a beautiful sound? That sonogram holds the sound of a baby's heartbeat. Hi, this is Janet Mefford, and I'd like to introduce you to the Ministry of Preborn. Preborn's mission is to provide free ultrasounds for young moms in pregnancy centers all around America for free, and they need your help. You can help Preborn save precious lives by sponsoring ultrasounds. Ultrasound is a game changer. By letting a mom hear her baby's heartbeat and see her baby in her womb, she will choose life 80% of the time. For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds. All gifts are tax deductible, and 100% of your gift goes to saving babies. You can save a baby's life right here in America by donating to Preborn. Join Janet Mefford today, and let's save 300 babies this summer. Will you help us? 855-601-BABY is the number to call, or donate securely at preborn.com. That's preborn.com. Please call 855-601-2229. That's 855-601-BABY. Everyone loves liberty. Our rights come from God, not from government. So why are you letting other people tell you what's best for your health care? Exercise your freedom with Liberty Health Share. Liberty Health Share is a community of people who voluntarily share one another's medical costs. Liberty Health Share is founded on the idea that most people truly want to help one another. Healthcare sharing allows members to do just that as a true community that supports one another in times of need. Liberty believes people should make decisions for themselves and their families. Members are able to take back the freedom to make their own decisions about their health care. Freedom from guilt or doubt about how your money is used. You have the freedom to direct your health care, not to be dictated to by bureaucrats. Stop letting others tell you what to do and join a community of like-minded people. Exercise your freedom. Join Liberty Health Share and take back the control of your health care while helping those around you. Call us at 855-58-LIBERTY for more information or check us out online at libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. We are back on Janet Mefford Today. I'm not really surprised by this. I don't think anybody is really surprised by this, but the Independent Journal Review reported on John McCain's statement to the tweets put out by President Trump on the trans military ban. He says it's why major policy announcements should not be made on Twitter. And I'm going to get into it in just a second. But stopping with that one line, I think one of the reasons that the president did want to do it on Twitter, I can't enter the mind of Donald Trump, but I would imagine part of the reason he wanted to do that is because you get immediate feedback. And some of it, I'm sure he doesn't like, but you also get feedback from people who are all for it. This is, I think, a medium that in some respects is a good medium for a politician because you can converse directly with the public for good or ill, and you can get immediate feedback. You can get immediate reactions. You can have people tell you things you didn't know and these sorts of things. But I don't know why, you know, John McCain, I feel very sorry for him. He's had this terrible diagnosis of a brain tumor, and I feel really bad for him. I don't mean to be criticizing him at such a difficult time, but this was the statement that Senator McCain put out. He said the president's tweet regarding transgender Americans in the military is yet another example of why major policy announcements should not be made on Twitter. He said the statement was unclear. The Department of Defense has already decided to allow currently serving transgender individuals to stay in the military, and many are serving honorably today. Well, again, they're serving honorably, and all the talk of patriotism and all the rest, that's beside the point. Nobody is saying that if you are suffering from gender dysphoria that you're not a patriot. Nobody is saying that you are not somebody who would be a good soldier in terms of the ability to carry out orders or anything. That's not the point. And this is, of course, a military veteran of the highest order who understands all of these things and is a Republican. So I'm not really sure what's going on there, other than the fact that we're all being propagandized here. It's about the military's ability, as I said, to fight and win wars. And it's about the common good of the military, what is best for the fighting forces. When you have all of these people who are part of the military who are being told you have to change the way you do X, Y, and Z to accommodate this teeny tiny group of people who are now being socially engineered into the military and are going to get all this free stuff and cost all this money, you have to allow them into your bathrooms and you have to just deal with it. Whether or not you feel violated, whether or not you feel like your privacy is being invaded, doesn't matter because that person is more important than you. That demoralizes people in the military, and they are being demoralized. They are feeling that. They talk about it. I talk to them. I interact with military families who say that exact thing. It's so demoralizing because we just have to accept it. So he goes on to talk about this, and he says, any American who meets current medical and readiness standards should be allowed to continue serving. There's no reason to force service members who are able to fight, train, and deploy to leave the military regardless of their gender identity. Now, I don't want to read any further on that because, first of all, there's no such thing as gender identity. These people have a mental health disorder. They need to get the help that they need in order to deal with that. And the fact that Vicky Hartzler couldn't even get enough Republicans to get on board with her amendment that would have prevented taxpayers from having to pay for sex change operations really means that there is something horribly wrong within the GOP. It's true. There's something horribly wrong. And President Trump did something extremely right. And whether or not he should have announced it on Twitter is immaterial to me, because for the last 8 years, we've had to see the left time after time after time after time shove the ideology down the throats of good and decent Americans who are saying, but that's fictitious. There's no such thing as a man trapped in a woman's body or vice versa. No, you're a hater. You're a transphobe. You're a whatever. List all the names that they call us anytime we have some sort of rational objection. And somebody finally put a stop to it. And good for him. And I feel bad that I ever thought that he wouldn't do that. I didn't think he would do it. Because he is from New York, and because he does have a history on these things, and because his daughter is very pro-LGBT and all the rest. All the reasons that I've looked at the administration sometimes with, you know, not the greatest look, because I know that they're not fully conservatives. But he did it here, and he deserves the credit for doing it here. Now, when I go back to this article that I talked about the other day, Michelle Curtella, who is the president over at the American College of Pediatricians, she was the one who was saying that as a pediatrician, transgender ideology, she says, has infiltrated her field and has produced large scale child abuse. And we talked about that. But it also bears repeating some of the data that she deals with in this this article that she wrote over at the Daily Signal a few weeks ago. And she says, for example, this is medically speaking. Twin studies prove no one is born trapped in the body of the wrong sex. Did you know about this? Some brain studies have suggested that some are born with a transgendered brain, but these studies are seriously flawed and prove no such thing. Virtually everything about human beings is influenced by our DNA, but very few traits are hardwired from birth. All human behavior is a composite of varying degrees for nature and nurture. Researchers routinely conduct twin studies to discern which factors contribute more to the expression of a particular trait. The best designed twin studies are those with the greatest number of subjects. Identical twins contain 100% of the same DNA from conception and are exposed to the same prenatal hormones. So, if genes and/or prenatal hormones contributed significantly to transgenderism, we should expect both twins to identify as transgender close to 100% of the time. Like skin color, it's determined by genes alone. And so identical twins have the same skin color 100% of the time. But in the largest study of twin transgender adults published by Dr. Milton Diamond in 2013, only 28% of the identical twins both identified as transgender. 72% of the time they differed. Now that matters, right? They're into settled science on the left, as far as I recall. So they should care about these sorts of things. They should look at the hard science. They should look at the data. Is it true that there's such a thing as a gay gene? No, there's no such thing as a gay gene. And on and on and on. Another point she makes, cross-sex hormones are associated with dangerous health risks. From studies of adults, we know that the risks of cross-sex hormones include, but are not limited to, cardiac disease, high blood pressure, blood clots, strokes, diabetes, and cancers. There's some more data. Then she says transition-affirming protocol has not solved the problem of transgender suicide. Adults who undergo sex reassignment, even in Sweden, which is among the most LGBT-affirming countries, have a suicide rate nearly 20 times greater than that of the general population. Clearly, sex reassignment is not the solution to gender dysphoria. So, when you hear these activists talking about the reason these transgenders are so messed up is because society does not accept them, it's not true. Sweden couldn't be more pro-LGBT. And look at these rates of suicide. And it's tragic, but it just proves that it would have been ridiculous to go down the road of providing sex change operations for military members. And we're always having to fight these things. So there you have it. And it's important for us to remember that when we're talking about these things with those who are so entrenched in this ideology, you do need to go back to these facts. You do need to go back to these studies. You do need to go back to people who do have solid credentials in the medical profession and can take these numbers and make sense of them for all of us. They do matter. What drives the left absolutely bonkers is when a decision is made that they didn't like. They can politic all day long. They can pressure all day long. They can lobby as much as they want. They can spend millions and millions and millions and millions of dollars trying to buy off politicians and influence policy and change the GOP from within to become pro-gay. They have been doing that for a long time. And the minute somebody turns around and says, no, we're not doing that, they go berserk. It's got to be their way, and it's got to be their way all the time, all the time. And that's why we need to push back, because some of the things they want for this country are not good for this country. Now, I want to remind you that we are trying to save 300 preborn babies' lives this summer. I've been talking about this great ministry, Preborn, and you know all about them. They help provide free ultrasounds to moms in crisis pregnancies who walk through the doors of crisis pregnancy centers. Statistics for those women show that 80% of them will choose life for their children if they're able to get an ultrasound. And so we need your help today. We're trying to get to that number of 300. We need 30 more people to step up and to be able to give a gift of $140. All you need to do is call 855-601-BABY. That's 855-601-BABY, 855-601-2229 is the phone number to call. Toll free, won't cost you anything. And if you can give a gift of a smaller amount, we would love to have you on board. We just need everyone who can possibly give a gift today to do that because we want to save lives. This is a no-brainer. We want to save lives. So the number again, 855-601-BABY, 855-601-2229. By the way, if you want to give online, JanetMefford.com, my website, there is a banner there to click. And we really appreciate your generosity. We really appreciate your heart for the lost and for these children. This is a great way not just to save lives, but to get the gospel to these moms, which Preborn does so beautifully. 855-601-BABY. Thanks a lot. We'll see you next time. God bless.